The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.
First, we're coming to you from Dublin Zoo as part of News Talk summer tour. We're getting around Wexford, Sligo, Killaloe, Killarney and Carlingford, thanks to ESB's 1,600 EV chargers across Ireland, giving you the freedom to go further. Dublin Zoo is one of the oldest zoos in the world, founded in 1831, open to visitors in 1840, so we're heading for almost 200 years of age as an institution. It's had a storied history. We'll hear some of that as we go throughout the programme. But first, we're going to take a look at some of the main stories of the day. I'm joined by political reporter and Indo Daily podcast presenter Tabitha Monaghan and editor of the Business Post Daniel McConnell to talk about these stories and whatever else has struck them overnight. Danny and Tabitha, good morning.
Morning, Pat. Morning.
All right, let's talk about the good news for news.
Yeah, so more people are willing to buy and pay for news, which is a good thing. As we've seen it in the Business Post, where, you know, subscriptions are up, you know, roughly 30% year on year, which is a good. So people are willing to pay for good quality premium content, which is great news for everybody involved in this industry. Obviously, the seismic change in terms of the decline of print is a structural decline. It's going, it's increasing, or it's continuing year on year. But it does show that there's a pathway for the news industry to continue into the future. And I think the trust levels, I think one of the most interesting aspects of the findings in the Reuters report, that this has been kind of, I suppose all of this is hanging on, and the annual digital news report for Ireland shows that more than half, that 56%, of the adult population are extremely or very interested in news.
I mean, one of the remarks in the newspapers today talking about this is that people trust local news very much, but it doesn't pay the bills.
No, it doesn't. And Danny's right. I think it comes as a huge relief for people who are working in the industry. Like, you love to hear things like this because, you know, like Danny said, there's such a move away from the traditional print journalism at the moment that a lot of it is online. It's a relief to hear that people want to pay for it now. Like you said, a lot of interest, an awful lot of trust in local newspapers and local radio as well. I think what was interesting as well is that there is still a significant level of concern in relation to what is real and what is fake online. So 68% of people saying that they are concerned. In terms of the demographics, the age demographics in that, 72% of people 65 and over are concerned, whereas 62% between 18 and 24. Another thing that was interesting is the use of AI as well, the chatbots. Like, so we know people are using social media. That's where people are going. So very much for us in The Independent, that's where we're trying to drive our traffic. That's where people are now. They're on their phones. That's where they are engaging with news. So it's making sure that those trusted brands are where the people are, but that some people are using AI chatbots, I think 5%. And like, it is a very small amount.
But there is growing distrust of AI.
There is a growing distrust of AI, but it's very, I can even see online now in the last little while, there's been an explosion of these videos, AI generated videos of newscasters that are, let's say, in a flooded street and they're saying, I am here, and they have a shark, like, you know, swimming around it. It is a concern because it will only improve, and it just it infiltrates everywhere.
Yeah, it's interesting. I don't know whether you saw overnight, Danny, the Department of Defense in the USA released pictures of the military parade, and they'd photoshopped the numbers.
Yeah, and this is what,
I mean, this is absolutely insane that a government department would actually lie just to please the Donald about the size of the crowd.
And this is echoes, you might remember Donald Trump's first week where Sean Spicer, you know, kind of had to articulate or argue how many people were at the initial inauguration. And, you know, it was like the biggest of all time. Clearly it wasn't. But this goes to the heart of the future of our industry, but also to democracy in terms of, if you can't rely on trusted sources, and we saw this very much during COVID-19, where there was a huge drawback or run back to established media at the start of COVID-19 in terms of getting accurate, reliable and authoritative and credible information as to what was going on. And we saw that every time that there was a COVID announcement, our numbers spiked because everyone wanted to know exactly where
and,
what the information
and it's
was.
Funny, when you hear it on national radio, like our own station or on RTE, or when you see it in print, it has a credibility that maybe seeing a post online doesn't happen.
Yeah, and even now I find, and like we were even talking earlier on, it's so busy at the moment. There's a huge amount of news even now, and that's actually what is reflected in these figures, that there's a, that where the, that number, that 56% of people saying that they're extremely interested, it's the highest since 2022, so it's up 3% year on year. Now, the peak was at 70% in 2021, which is understandable because that was the COVID pandemic. But interesting is that when there's stuff going on, whether it's the housing crisis and the rent pressure zones, or this huge amount of international news and what's going on with tariffs, that people are coming back to trusted news sources.
Now, a couple of stories that are kind of related. We see that private hospitals are getting 60% of the public funds that go to the National Treatment Purchase Scheme, and 40% going to the public hospitals themselves. And even that stat is, you know, raises a question. I mean, why are the public hospitals able to have the capacity to do extra work and get it from the NTPF instead of doing it themselves in the first place?
Because you're goading me now, Pat, because you know this is one of my pet peeves. Yeah. So ultimately, a lot of the public hospital system operates on a Monday to Friday basis. It doesn't operate at weekends, so you have perfectly good theatres lying idle for large periods of time in major acute hospitals. Therefore, the government, you know, literally kind of rather than looking to drive those reforms in terms of work practices, they have looked to the national, they set up this National Treatment Purchase Fund way back. It was reignited about 10 years ago. Roughly about 20 million at that time was the amount of money. It's now at 100 million. So you can see how it is growing and growing and growing. Ultimately, it's a safety, it's a workaround the system in order to get people off the list or to reduce the waiting list. We know that Stephen Donnelly, when he was health minister, started...
Hang on a second, Danny. I just want to try to understand this. Mm. We have all the people in the public hospitals crying that we're worked too hard. We haven't a moment to spare. Every moment of the working day when we go in, we're exhausted, we're knackered, we're put upon. Yet we have time at the weekends to do more stuff.
Yeah, so...
On overtime. Yeah. Just to go figure.
So clearly there is capacity, you would think, and certainly in terms from an infrastructure perspective, the theatres are lying idle. There are people who are willing to work overtime, etc. like that. So it's a case of, and we know at the point I was just going to make is that Jennifer Carroll McNeill, the current health minister, and her predecessor Stephen Donnelly had begun this process of trying to break that pattern. They want a 7 day a week kind of hospital system. The difficulty is that obviously you've got vested interests, you've consultants on one side, you have very powerful trade unions on the other hand trying to defend their workers' rights, etc., trying to resist the change in their work practices. I'm not saying there are not people in the health service who work 7 days a week, there clearly are, but what we don't have is sufficient capacity in the system at weekends to make sure that these log jams don't happen or these lengthy waiting lists happen. And as a result, the taxpayer is paying huge amounts of money to private hospital providers in order to reduce the waiting list.
But you see, you could understand that if the public hospitals are absolutely full to the brim, they're doing everything they can, they're trundling along at full speed. Therefore, you have to use private hospitals, whether in Sweden or Spain or Northern Ireland or whatever they might be, you might have to do that. But the idea that you actually can pay public hospitals to do the job they should be doing anyway.
Yeah, it beggars belief, but it does show you, I suppose, the idiosyncrasies of the Irish health system.
Where I think this could possibly go as well is that is value for money. And I think an awful lot of these stories, that's where it goes back to, because that's the narrative at the moment. So when we see the likes of these hospitals that the Treatment Purchase Fund is spending 60% of its treatment in private hospitals, and that's only steadily been going up since 2017. I think one of the figures was 9.8 million was going to private hospitals, and that was a budget for this fund of 20 million. So if it's going up and up and up, what are people getting for that? Because I think people would still argue there's still long waiting lists. I think there was a memo that went to Cabinet, it was in the Sunday Times over the weekend, that the trolley crisis was laid bare, that 19% more patients were on trolleys at the June bank holiday than the May bank holiday. So there's an awful lot of questions still there. But definitely, I think while it is true that there is definitely capacity, you know, go start working in the evenings, on the weekends, on the bank holidays, there are still a lot of people working in the health service that are definitely put upon, like the likes of the nurses, etc. There is an awful lot of pressure on them.
Okay, and the related story is Paul Reid is going to be the boss of the new On Board Planola, which should be on commission. A rose by any other name, you know, would smell as foul or as sweet, depending on how you want to view it. But I mean, Paul Reid, does he know anything at all about planning? And don't forget, he was running the HSE and he was one of the people who failed to bring in 7 day working.
Yeah, and I think to give Paul Reid some degree of credit, I mean, he was Director General of the HSE during COVID, so it was probably the opportunity to, and again, that's one reason. But I do take your point that reforms didn't really happen on his watch. I think from, you know, after the Brendan McDonagh debacle, in terms of he was the clear favourite to be the housing czar, you know, figurehead to try and drive reform in this area, Paul Reid has emerged as the sort of the second choice to do this. Whether he knows about housing or not is probably limited. Now, he is a former chief executive of Fingal County Council, where, you know, there's some role there in house building. But I think that the big win or the big sell of Paul Reid is that he knows the system. He's a former apparatchik of Robert Watt in the Department of Public Expenditure. He negotiated the Croke Park deals 1 and 2. Like, so he knows the system intimately. So therefore, he's probably a good person to try and break down. He knows where the landmines are. He knows where the roadblocks are. He can get them out of the way.
Yeah, part of this, though, is that they want a completely restructuring of the system that we currently have. So that's part of the reason for changing on board Planola, that, you know, there was a frustration that that decision weren't being made quick enough. So that's one of the things that I think the Housing Minister James Brown wants to see with this. So there's going to be a restructure of the organisation, there's going to be a new governing board, there's going to be we understand statutory mandatory timelines, so that'll give applicants more certainty in relation to anything that has gone there. So I think the proof will be in the pudding with this one.
Yeah, and I mean, I suppose having exited early from the HSE, he will want to show us what he can do.
Yeah, I think, you know, you're not going to take a job on like that, you know, without a realistic understanding that you need to deliver. And housing will be the one issue that I think this government will be adjudicated upon now, come 2029.
Speaking of housing, Michael Healy-Rae and Wood.
Yeah. He wants to bring forward a plan, or is bringing forward a plan, that timber houses are the way forward. That, you know, to supplement and to add to the stock of delivery of housing, that timber houses are what is needed. This is in addition to, obviously, we know modular housing has been...
Are we talking about like timber frame housing, which is there, it's an existing technology, or are we talking about that log cabin in the Wilds of Kerry?
I think it's to use more and embrace timber more, and that I think this is Michael Healy-Rae, who's the forestry minister, and this is now being brought to cabinet by Agriculture Minister Martin Hayden. It's this interim report on work that is being done by the Timber in Construction Steering Group. So it's basically saying that we have a huge amount of resources in terms of forestry and we should be using it more, that it's there, it's eco-friendly, that, you know, if we're using forestry more, it's you know, in relation to how it benefits the climate, and that we should be using it more, and that we need to embrace it more.
All right. Moving on to another, I suppose, old political chestnut, but it looks like it might have some legs this time round, Danny, and that's a two-tiered child benefit system being floated. Now, a lot of the kites that fly actually land with a thump.
Yeah.
They never really go anywhere.
Yeah. So this, the idea is that people on lower incomes would see a kind of an enhanced payment in order, I suppose, in recognition of the cost of living pressures that have been seen. And also as well, there has long been the criticism that millionaires and very wealthy people get child benefits. So therefore, you would look to prioritise or give priority to those on lower incomes. Where the lines are to be drawn or where you separate one category from another remains to be seen. But where those lines are drawn are often very contentious, because you've often found people who are not entitled to any sort of benefit just above that threshold getting nothing, where people on similar or just below them getting everything. And so it'll be very delicate, I think, for the government. But this is in the context of that national economic dialogue that took place at Dublin Castle yesterday. And ultimately, I suppose, you've got difficult decisions coming from the government. You know, they were dampening down expectations about the level of spending that's possible. We're talking no tax increases come, you know, the budget, even though the last government made it play on reducing the burden of income tax. So there are difficult decisions that are coming down the line.
But can you see any parties in government saying we're going to have two levels, one for the rich, which will be low, and one for the disadvantaged, which would be very high?
Well, I think
the mantra, and you've heard it again and again, people saying, I get nothing from the state. Yeah. Because some people get everything. I get nothing except the child benefit.
Except the child. But if there was still a left-leaning party in government, I would say there was probably more of a chance of this. The fact that this is now very much a centre-right government, I would think that, while the Taoiseach said everything is still on the table and nothing has been shut off, I would be doubtful to see this in the final shake-up.
Yeah, we have heard quite a lot as well about the government wanting to tackle child poverty. We heard it like prior to the last election as well, and I think this is one of the ways that they want to do it continuing on. Again, though, there's an awful lot of difficult decisions that need to be made in a very difficult situation, because we are in the middle of this 90-day pause in relation to Trump's tariffs, and I think that's one of the things that we're hearing now coming out of government sources anyway, saying, yes, we have these difficult decisions. Either the likes of income tax cuts aren't going to happen, Dublin or the bans are going to be changed. That was quite a few promises that we heard from Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael during the election. Unlikely to happen now because we don't know what's coming. I think, I don't know if it was Taoiseach Simon Harris who said yesterday that there's this dark cloud coming. It's whether or not that's rain or hail, because we don't know what's coming with, in relation to these tariffs. Whether or not they can get this across the line and how palatable it will be in relation to the two-tier child benefit, we have to wait and see.
It looks like the bones of some sort of a deal have been struck between the UK and the US, even though no detailed work has been done. But the prospect of the EU accepting 10% tariffs across the board in exchange for no tariffs on US goods, that's been floated around, heard it on the Business Breakfast this morning, so whether that will fly. But speaking of child poverty, a poverty of child places at Oberstown, leading to people who should be held on remand being free to do what they like.
Yeah, so this is a story that was on the front of the Irish Times this morning, and basically that two individuals who were essentially brought into custody at the weekend over a pretty drastic incident in Shankill.
Described as a savage attack.
Savage attack in Shankill. Were brought to Oberstown essentially for detention, but were told literally there's no room at the inn and therefore had to be let go, because ultimately there's a limit on the number of places. These are high-intensity facilities where those in there need a high level of attention, but it does not sit well in a law and order society if people who are involved in such savage attacks are being let go.
It looks like, Tabitha, that we prepare for nothing. We have under capacity in virtually every area of Irish life.
Yeah, completely. And actually something that I think Justice Minister Jim O'Callaghan had introduced or brought to Cabinet maybe last week or the week before was this accelerated projects to try and ramp up prison places. So I think it was potentially 960 additional prison places, and to have them in by 2030, because we know that prison capacity at the moment is way over at the right now, without people going out on bail. And there's been questions about people going out on bail as well. So I think whether or not Jim O'Callaghan there also extends this to the likes of Oberstown to be able to expand capacity there as well, there'd be certainly questions to answer.
All right, some of the texts coming in. Routine procedures are being cancelled Monday to Friday to facilitate A&E overflow. Weekends are being used to catch up on routine ops rather than on urgent cases. Please explain to me who's going to cover Tuesday and Wednesday, for example, if I, as a healthcare assistant, am rostered Saturday and Sunday. Where are the extra staff coming from? All very well operating theatre to work over the weekend. However, there are not enough beds. You've people waiting in A&E for a bed, waiting 24 to 48 hours. So should we consider day cases? But occasionally they might need a bed. Emergency surgery does happen over the weekend, but if staff are tied up with minor cases, it's complicated, needs adequate staffing and adequate beds. As so much more we could be talking about, but for the moment, my thanks to Daniel McConnell, editor of the Business Post, and Tabitha Monnan, political reporter with the Irish Independent and Indo Daily podcast.
The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.